You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us at Brookings. My name is Michael O'Hanlon. I'm in the foreign policy program at Brookings and joined by my colleagues, Frank Rose and Mara Carlin. We're all hosting today a good friend, an amazing scholar and entrepreneur and experienced Washington aide to Senator McCain and others, Chris Brose, who has written a remarkable book called The Kill Chain, Defending America in the Future of High-Tech Warfare. It's a book that came out of his service with Senator McCain on the Senate Armed Services Committee in recent years, and also derives, I think, in large part from his background in the Bush administration, although at that time he was thinking more along State Department lines, writing speeches for Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. But he was thinking strategically then. He spent a half dozen years after that time as a senior advisor to Senator McCain before becoming the youngest staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee in history. And he's now also the CEO of a company called Anduril, where he is promoting high-tech innovative solutions to some of the problems he writes about in the book. He hails from the great state of Pennsylvania outside of Philadelphia. And Chris, we're just really thrilled to have you with us today. So thanks for joining us. And I'm going to begin now with a few questions for Chris. We're not going to have a formal presentation per se. I'm going to kick off the Q&A. And then we will ask Frank and Mara to also come in with some questions of their own, just to explore some of the big themes and main ideas in the book. And we'll reserve the last 20 minutes or so for your questions. And so I think you're aware, having registered for the event, of how you can send those in. But let me now launch right in, Chris. And both in your opening pages of the book and also in your excellent Wall Street Journal op-ed over the weekend, you talked about a memory of a conversation that you had had with Senator McCain that came partly out of some discussions of combat simulations and war games that people like David Achmanek at the Pentagon had been holding that really put the fear of God into you about America's military capabilities, especially vis-a-vis China. I wondered if you could just tell that story in a nutshell to motivate for people why this book needed to be written and why you feel so powerfully about the argument you make in it.
Yeah, no, thank you. And thanks for having me. It's really an opportunity, a wonderful opportunity to be with you guys this morning. And I'm grateful. The story that starts the book was really kind of an anecdote that sort of crystallized to me the problem that I think we have. And it had been really the focus of much of the work that Senator McCain and I and the rest of the members of the committee, the staff of the committee had done for the years that he was chairman, years leading up to that, which was just the recognition, sort of creeping recognition, that we were not as a country where we needed to be from the standpoint of national defense, that we had been significantly disrupted by China's military modernization. And not the fact that they had, you know, played the same game that we were playing, but they were playing a very different game. And that they had made a lot of progress that I think many people in the Congress just weren't fully aware of the extent of. So, you know, in that period of time, you know, kind of 2017, there was a lot of, wrestling over the budget and trying to get stable funding, trying to deal with the impacts of the Budget Control Act and sequestration. And, you know, this was an idea that we had around trying to sort of crystallize in the minds of members of the Senate what the stakes were, and really sort of get them focused on not just the need to sort of stabilize the budget picture and sort of increase funding where that was appropriate, but to really begin making this shift to a different kind of force. And Dave Achmanek was there, and basically the thrust of it was looking at how the United States, kind of matches up against peer competitors, which at the time was sort of increasingly the focus of senior leaders in the Department of Defense, as well as Senator McCain and those of us on the committee. And the basic concern is that, you know, when you sort of look in full at the military capabilities that China has been developing and fielding, they have purpose-built a military to undermine the assumptions on which the U.S. military has been built and the way that we have planned to operate it for a very long period of time. And you kind of go down the list of, you know, kind of the order of battle here with respect to long-range sensors, long-range precision-guided weapons, you know, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, increasingly hypersonic missiles, counter-space capabilities, cyber capabilities, the ability to really target America's forward bases in the Asia-Pacific, which we had long assumed would be sanctuaries from which we could build up forces in the event of a contingency, project power, sustain military operations through the duration of a conflict. You know, the way in which we rely upon information, both in the terrestrial environment, but increasingly in space as well, how we command and control our forces. You know, this was a military arsenal that has been built up systematically. I mean, this wasn't like a hurricane that happened one day. This was something that had been playing out for years and years and years. And I think in part because of that, you know, in part because of other things that we were focused on as a nation, you know, we just weren't attentive to how much progress was being made systematically, you know, kind of year by year. And I think what really crystallized it for us was really looking at some of these simulations, which, you know, I think most people in the Congress, you know, aren't really paying attention to, aren't witting of. Certainly, I think most people in the country are not either. But when it comes to people who really track these issues in the Department of Defense, you know, what I think was so shocking to us was the disconnect, you know, that, you know, for people like Dave Akmanek or, you know, perhaps Mara when she was there in the Pentagon, you know, these were things that, you know, were kind of understood. And, you know, obviously it motivated a sense of urgency to get after that problem. But the problem on the Hill was that people just weren't aware of it. And, you know, the sort of the argument that I make in the book and the reason we sort of sought to make this case to the Congress was, you know, if you don't have a, you know, if there's not a consensus in the country that you even have a problem, it's hard to build a consensus that you need to build a better solution for that. So that was really the thrust of what we sought to set up. And for the members who were there, it was a pretty stark dose of reality.
Thank you. And I want to make sure also that we get up front in this conversation the essence of your alternative concept for what you think is a realistic way to think about military modernization for the United States, because you do discuss specific budgetary proposals and certain kinds of weapons and technologies. I want to come to that next before handing off to Frank and Mara. But you also have sort of a bigger idea, an overarching theme about how you believe we should view the realistic capabilities that we can develop in the future. And again, I'm going to invite you to pick up the thread here, but I think it ultimately crystallizes around the idea that it's not going to be realistic for the United States to establish the kind of dominance that we had, let's say, in the Pacific against China during the Cold War, where it was, for all intents and purposes, an American lake, even within eyesight of the Chinese coastline, that we're going to be living in a world that's contested on both sides, and that the realistic standard for us is not to figure out how to be able to sail aircraft carriers safely 10 miles off the Chinese shore again, like we once could. Those days are sort of gone forever. And the more appropriate goal is to make sure that China also would be deprived of the ability to dominate the Western Pacific. And we sort of use an anti-access area denial concept against them, rather than trying to or hoping that we could somehow overcome their ability to use it against us. I don't want to suggest that it's completely either or. Obviously, some role for defenses, some role for American power projection is, I think, probably still part of your thinking and the Pentagon's. But do I have that right, that the basic concept should be depriving China of the ability to dominate the Western Pacific, rather than thinking that we can reestablish the kind of omnipotence there that we once had?
Yeah, I think in a nutshell, you've got it right. You know, what I argue in the book is that, you know, for really 30 years now, since the end of the Cold War, we've been living in this kind of aberrational period in history where we've been so dominant. You know, we've been living in this unipolar world that we've kind of come to assume that this is how it's going to be and be forever. But when you really sort of look at that period across, you know, the sweep of history, it is an aberration. And I think things are starting to kind of revert more to the historical norm, which is great power rivalry, competition, you know, kind of pushing and shoving, you know, an emerging power in China, which I think is actually more than a great power. I think, you know, more in terms of a peer competitor, provided they continue on the path that they're on economically, technologically, militarily. You know, this is a challenge that's going to far outstrip what the Soviet Union was able to muster. Which we kind of hold up as the classic great power competition. So when it comes to how we think about this problem from a military standpoint, you know, and I'd be the first one, you know, you mentioned my time at the State Department, I'd be the first one to say that this is a strategic challenge that goes far beyond, you know, the military. And that's something that we have to be very cognizant of, that the other tools of power are going to be just as important, perhaps even more important in this competition. But from a military standpoint, I do think we need to start by readjusting our objectives. You know, this is not going to be, you know, kind of the reassertion of American military primacy the way that it was 20 years ago. But I don't think that that is sort of a cause for despair. I think that, you know, we can think about defense in the absence of the kind of military dominance that we have come to enjoy. And still, I think, put together a strategy, ends, ways, and means that enables us to achieve objectives that, you know, that are important for us, that allows us to kind of defend the people, places, and things in the world that we absolutely have to. And I think with that in mind, you know, the idea of sort of flipping anti-access area denial around is something that, you know, you and others have written about. And I personally think that is going to be generally the right answer for us, you know, that we don't have to control all of this territory, all of this space. But denying the, you know, the ability of a competitor to control that space, you know, to project power into it, to commit acts of aggression or coercion into those areas, I think that is a doable military objective. But again, I think that leads you to think differently about, you know, the ways and means of American military power, which I try to think through in the book. And essentially, that boils down to, you know, we have to sort of think about a world in which we're not going to have sanctuary the way that we have assumed, you know, really anywhere. We're not going to have time on our side the way that we once assumed, you know, we would be able to start a war 6 months after the point of aggression, sort of at a time of our choosing. You know, we're going to have to be much more forward. We're going to be much more reliant on allies for a whole host of things, not least military capability. But then when it comes to the kind of force that we're building, you know, the force that we have, I think, is largely built upon assumptions that are increasingly being overturned. And, you know, we have a force that's built around, you know, small numbers of very large, expensive, exquisite, sort of manpower intensive and hard to replace things. And those things are going to have a really difficult time surviving, I think, on this future battlefield. I think the opportunity that technology presents is really to focus on what we're trying to achieve in terms of the outcomes rather than the inputs, which is ultimately the way to think about getting military modernization right. We're not trying to build better versions of things we've had for a very long time and operate them in the same ways. We're trying to solve these problems differently, build different kinds of forces. And for me, in a nutshell, you know, the opportunity of these emerging technologies, when you really kind of look at them together, is to build an almost, you know, kind of inversion of our current military, which would really take the form of sort of increasingly large networks of, you know, smaller, cheaper, kind of more expendable, more autonomous systems. You don't have to have so much manpower behind every system. You can actually have lots of systems being operated by single individuals because of their levels of autonomy and intelligence. I think this is an enormous opportunity, especially as we look at kind of the pace that China's on, as the pacing threat, but by no means the only challenge that we're going to have to deal with in the world. But I think the one that it makes the most sense for us to baseline against as we think about, you know, kind of building toward that most stressing case that we might have to face one day.
That's excellent. And I want to follow up now a little more budgetarily and programmatically as to what this means. And I've just got two more questions because I want to come back finally to the role of Congress in all of this, since you and I both spent a lot of time on the Hill, and I know we both recognize that Congress has the constitutional power to write budgets, and its role is crucial. But I was intrigued in your book to wrestle with sort of an intellectual tension, if you'll forgive me for putting it that way. And I think it's a tension that's inevitable for someone like you who lives in the real world and knows that things change evolutionarily and slowly and incrementally in an organization like the Department of Defense. You don't just tell a big story about robots and small network systems and all of a sudden, you know, wave your magic wand and they all appear. You've got a lot of history in the book that talks about people like Admiral Moffett and General Shriver, who developed carriers and ICBMs back in earlier eras. But you also talk about just how much of the Pentagon budget would have to change today to steer us in a direction that you feel is consistent with trends in warfare and these new realistic goals that you lay out. And in your Wall Street Journal op-ed, you say maybe we could even do this, you know, not that you were advocating smaller budgets, but you recognize U.S. military spending may have peaked for a while, and we can probably implement a lot of the agenda that you're laying out, even without growing the budget, if necessary. But I was struck that you said even just 5% of the Pentagon budget being redirected could make a big difference in pursuing the agenda that you laid out. And I wanted to ask you to sort of reflect on the tension in your argument. And again, I don't think it's a contradiction. I think it's because you live in the real world and you know how things really get done. But on the one hand, you're laying out a very big alternative idea for the future of warfare that's radically different in many ways from what we've been doing and what we continue to build and modernize and acquire in the Department of Defense. On the other hand, you're saying we can do a lot of this by just shifting 5% of DOD's budget per year in different directions. Could you explain how, if we're trying to almost create a revolution here, we can do it by just shifting only 5% of the budget, if you see what I'm driving at?
Yeah, for sure. And it's a great question, and it's one that I struggle with a lot in the book. I mean, I think the challenges I see it is that defense spending prior to COVID, was already flattening and I think starting to turn down. And that was sort of the projection before this latest crisis, with several $1 trillion moving out the door for stimulus, which, was necessary. I think that's going to just put increased pressure on the top line, even more than was already there. So, it's not so much to say that, we're going to have to, potentially look at how, we could do this with less. I think we're going to have to do it with less. I just think this is going to become, kind of a political and fiscal reality for the foreseeable future. In terms of how to make this transition, I mean, and I want to be clear, I do think of it as a transition, right? I mean, it's not, and you know this, I mean, many of the people listening know this, you can't sort of snap your fingers and all of a sudden get a completely different kind of, military capabilities kind of integrated into the force with sort of training and doctrine around how to use them at scale. But it's like the old adage of, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago and today. Like, you just have to start. The frustration that I had in my time in the Congress was, looking at how the budget was put together. And I talk about this a bit in the book. There was a definition of priorities for the year as that budget was built. Then it was sort of delegated down to, the services, the agencies to begin building their, their programs from the bottom up. And it only felt like at the very end of that process did the Secretary of Defense and senior leaders, kind of get the reins back into their hands to say, okay, now what are we going to fund? So it was sort of tantamount to, everybody ate first. And then with about, a small amount of, food left over, the most important things were fighting at the very end for the table scraps. To me, this is a process that I think we're going to have to kind of experiment our way through. And I try to, emphasize here that, I don't know what the right answers are. I mean, I have a general sense of what I think the right answers are, but I do believe this is something that we're going to have to kind of feel our way through and recognize that we're not necessarily always going to know what the right answers are going to be. And there are going to be cases where emerging technologies are going to be the right answers. There are going to be others where really the right answer is going to be using a capability that we've had for a very long time, like a B-52, for example, in a very different way. Or somehow marrying, kind of old and new to get the answer that you want. And I think for me, the process is about, establishing a process where you could focus on the outcomes you are trying to achieve, compete technologies, programs, organizations against one another to come up with the best solution, and have a process every year where you had real money at stake for who could provide that best solution. And to not care, about balancing the resource split between the services or, among, defense companies or, the labs or whomever. It should really be a process where we baseline against, what are the operational problems we're trying to solve? What are the best solutions that we can field right now to solve those problems? And really create an ability to on-ramp new capability each year and do it at scale so that, companies old and new really see something worth fighting for and a priority worth really going after because they stand to gain, significant resources if they can bring better capabilities to bear. And I ultimately think that's how you, kind of better align the incentives for how the private sector can really support what we're trying to do in this, this transitional process from the military we have to the military we need. create incentives for them to put more of their own independent research and development funding into building new kinds of capabilities. But again, the main point here is that this is going to be a transition. It's going to play out over a long period of time. It's more about setting up a process where we're going to have confidence that, you know, we're going to be able to experiment and come up with solutions each year that are going to be better than the ones we've had and sort of lead us down this path of figuring out, you know, how do we make resource decisions around the things that are best now? And then the flip side of that is, how do we divest of things that we're going to have to get off of our books because, either the expense is too significant or the capability doesn't add up and match up to, you know, what we're currently capable of fielding.
So just a quick clarifying question before my last one on the role of Congress. So just to take one example, you're not necessarily saying eliminate the entire aircraft carrier fleet because these are now sitting ducks in the open ocean. You're saying perhaps, and again, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, maybe we should prioritize aircraft carriers a bit less, recognizing they may not be survivable if they're deployed all the way to the Western Pacific, but we still have roles for them in certain other theaters. Or maybe we develop an unmanned long-range strike aircraft that can operate off a carrier and keep the aircraft and the carrier further out of range of Chinese or Russian weapons so that we can still use that existing platform, but in an innovative way that doesn't make it vulnerable quite as much as in the past. That's the kind of thinking you're talking about?
Yeah, and really trying to baseline it around real world operational problems. Not to sort of, you know, end up in a room where everyone is kind of asserting what they believe to be reality and sort of the strongest voice wins, or you cut some messy compromise where, you know, everyone walks away a bit unhappy, but with part of the resources. I certainly lived that dream when I was in the Congress. I know, many things work that way in the DoD. It's more about saying, look, why do we have aircraft carriers? What is the problem that we are actually seeking to solve here? And the answer will likely be for many years to come, we will continue to need those platforms. We will continue to have to think about, to your point, you know, if we could extend the range of the carrier air wing, you know, that is a way of making the carrier more relevant, even though we're facing the kinds of anti-access area denial challenges that we're looking at from the Chinese. But it's ultimately to say, if we're focusing on the problem that we have that system to solve, it creates a level playing field for other alternative solutions to be brought to the table, compete on the merits, so we can actually have a conversation about, you know, what works best at achieving outcomes. And if the answer is, you know, we need to trade a carrier or two for large quantities of anti-access area denial, sort of precision strike weaponry, kind of ground-based long-range fires. That's an interesting trade. I'd like to see how that competes out, you know, in a real-world scenario to make an informed decision about what's the best use of limited resources.
Thank you. And now my last question. I love in the book how every so often there's a bit of an homage to the great John McCain, who you had the privilege of working for and helping so many years. We had the privilege of hosting at Brookings. They'll always go down to some of my personally most powerful and grateful memories of my career at Brookings, the chance to host the great senator. And this is, of course, a testimony as well to the importance of Congress. And one of the things that you say in the book, where you're almost hesitantly picking a little bit of a debate with the late senator who opposed earmarks so categorically, and you said, you know what, maybe earmarks are okay as long as they're transparent and the reason for which we put them in is clearly debated and clearly available to the public, because sometimes Congress has a good idea that the Pentagon does not, or sometimes the Pentagon ultimately bows to the political dictates of a White House, or, you know, the Pentagon is still run by human beings and under the political leadership of an individual in the White House who of whatever party may or may not always get it right. So you want Congress to have a strong role. Could you just say a word about that? And again, I really enjoyed the way you were almost feeling slightly guilty of debating your late great boss, but you felt that he had it sort of 90% right, but there might be an even better way to follow this concept in the future.
Yeah, I think, you know, the two points. I mean, the broader point is the one you made, which is, you know, recognizing at the end of the day that the Department of Defense doesn't build budgets. They build budget requests. And at the end of the day, it's Congress that is going to make the decision about what gets funded to what levels and really sort of determines where we're putting our money as a nation into the military. Obviously, that's informed by the DoD, but the decision makers are on the Hill. So, you know, I think one of the things that we struggled to do and succeeded to a large extent, but, you know, really struggled to do was just fight for members' time, right? I mean, get them focused on these decisions, really get them to a place where they could feel confident about making hard calls to, you know, cut away from things that maybe were programs that we needed to stop putting as much money into, understand the importance of some of these new investments we needed to make. Because at the end of the day, that was their power and they needed to use it. They needed to use it wisely. They needed to use it strategically. And Congress has awesome power to exercise in that regard. I think an element of that, which I touch on, is the question of earmarks, congressionally directed spending, if we're using the politically correct term. I fought about this with Senator McCain, but I knew it was a losing battle. And look, the reality is earmarks were banned for a good reason. He was not wrong that they had become a source of corruption. They did need to be checked. My concern, and the longer I stayed in the Congress, the more I came to believe this, was that we had just thrown the baby out with the bathwater. You know, that at the end of the day, Congress's constitutional prerogative is to build the budgets that will fund the military, you know, to raise armies and sustain navies. When Congress takes away the ability to say they think they have an idea that is worthy of funding, that the Pentagon is missing or actively, neglecting, Congress has to have an ability, to your point, to put money into something that they believe is strategically important. There are bad ways that this can play out, but there are ways in which I think it can play out very, very soundly, where there just needs to be transparency, you know, so that people know who is asking for what and why. And then these things can be evaluated on their merits. And I think there are plenty of instances in the past where, you know, you take a look at, you know, the beginning of unmanned aircraft, you know, in recent times, you know, with the Predator and the advent of that. And that began as an earmark because the Air Force wanted nothing to do with unmanned aviation for a long period of time. And Congress eventually said, you know, we're just going to force it down your throat and establish this program. It's not to say that this is how it has to be all of the time. I mean, these probably should be the exceptions. The DoD is going to get a lot right. But Congress, I think, really emasculates itself when it takes away its own power to direct resources to priorities that it believes, you know, merit greater attention than the department's giving it.
Fantastic. So now I'm going to turn to Frank and then to Mara, each for their own brief reactions to your excellent book. And then they'll each probably have a question or two for you as well. And then again, for the last 10 to 15 minutes, we'll come back to me to handle some audience questions. Frank Rose, over to you, my friend.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. Chris, great book. I can tell you're a former speechwriter because it reads so easily, but it's also very informative and gets the key points out. I think after reading the book, my key takeaway is that you are trying to impart on the American people the fact that the United States has lost conventional superiority against China. I know this is very difficult for some Americans to accept, but I think it's true. And I think you do a nice job at detailing how we've lost that capability and how effective the Chinese in particular have been in developing these asymmetric capabilities, anti-satellite weapons, offensive cyber capabilities, medium and intermediate range ballistic missiles to negate our conventional advantages. So on that note, I had two questions that build on those points. You know, first, over the past 25 years, presidents of both parties in the United States have argued that America's conventional superiority allowed us to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our defense strategy. That was a theme that was in the Bush Nuclear Posture Review in 2002 and the Obama administration posture review in 2010. Now that we no longer have that clear conventional advantage, what are the implications for U.S. nuclear strategy, especially extended deterrence. We have a lot of politicians on Capitol Hill now calling for the United States to adopt a no first use policy. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. And then second, throughout the book, you rightfully note the importance of outer space systems to the future of warfare. Right now, the United States is in the process of standing up the U.S. Space Force. As we stand up that force, what steps do you think we need to take to ensure that the new service ensures the types of reforms that you recommend in the book? Thanks.
Those are two awesome questions, and thank you, Frank. On the first, with respect to nuclear weapons, you know, your analysis is right. I think, you know, you could sort of look at the point that we're at right now and go a different direction than the one that I did, which is to say we're losing conventional military deterrence, so we need to rely more heavily on our strategic deterrent. I don't go that way because honestly, that's not a world I want to live in. I don't think that it's a good outcome for us to be, you know, kind of left in a situation where every challenge that we have, you know, every dispute that we have, you know, be it with China or be it with another competitor, has to be escalated up to sort of the brink of nuclear conflict or the threat of nuclear conflict as a way of maintaining deterrence. I think that we have to have that nuclear deterrent. I think part of the challenge, which I touch on just very briefly in the book, is that, you know, while we have been de-emphasizing the role of nuclear weapons in our national defense and foreign policy, not just China, but Russia and other competitors have actually been going the opposite direction. I mean, they've been building up, they've been modernizing, they've been relying upon these capabilities even more, not less. And I think we've been slow to realize that too. Personally, I go in the direction of saying, you know, we need to put the emphasis on reestablishing conventional deterrence and think differently about how we achieve it. And I think that's sort of a holistic rethinking. And part of it is, you know, like we touched on earlier, this isn't going to be, we'll just change kind of how and what we operate with. But, you know, as far as the goals, it's going to be 1995 all over again. Like, we actually need to change our objectives for the world that I think we're in and moving into. And then, you know, from that flows different ways of operating, different things that we would use to operate with, but really kind of asserting conventional, reestablishing conventional deterrence from the standpoint of, you know, how you build defense without dominance. And I think that we have the opportunity. I think we can do that. I don't think that is impossible. And I think it's possible even under, you know, kind of the fiscal environment that we're going to be living in, you know, for the foreseeable future. I think the challenge is, you know, we can't neglect the role of nuclear weapons in our national defense, particularly because we have adversaries that are relying upon them more. But for me, you know, the choice is not, you know, well, we're losing conventional military overmatch, thus let's rely even more on nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear conflict. With respect to the second question, to me, space is actually the place where many of the things that I write about in the book, I think, come together most, you know, kind of poignantly. You know, it's where the problem is the most acute in a certain respect, you know, that we have for decades assumed that space was going to be a sanctuary for the United States and our military, that really no one was going to be able to affect us or touch us there. I think when you look at how technology is changing how we operate in space, it's also, you know, one of the areas that is perhaps being disrupted the most, you know, where we're now seeing more satellites launched, you know, year over year, you know, than entire decades before us, you know, where, you know, the heavens are just going to be crowded with, you know, increasingly large numbers of small satellites, constellations all over the place. I think this is, you know, this is an area where technology is just fundamentally going to change how we operate. And that's just thinking about it conventionally, right? You know, sort of space as a way of gaining better understanding about what's going on the Earth. You know, but these technologies are also going to allow us to really think about space as its own domain of military operations, you know, where we will have things and people based on orbit. We will have, bases on the moon. We will have manufacturing and sort of supplies based in outer space. And we will be conducting military operations, not just, you know, from space to the Earth, but in space itself. That whole domain is going to become contested, and, you know, it's going to become an expanded area of military competition. So to the question about the Space Force, look, I was there for much of the debate over the creation of Space Force in the years that I was on the Hill. The Congress did not create the Space Force because they believed that things were going well for the United States in space. So I think the real opportunity for the Space Force is to recognize that they have a political mandate from the legislature to think about this problem completely differently. You know, and that goes to, you know, how we recruit and retain, you know, Americans as part of this military force. It goes to how we acquire technology and build programs, you know, how we budget for our operations, and ultimately just how we think differently from a warfighting perspective of how we think about space as a warfighting domain. I think all of that is on the table. And I think this organization needs to basically take a clean sheet of paper to each of these problems. And I think that if they come back with ambitious, you know, ideas for how to reimagine America's role, really the American military's role in space, I think they're going to find a lot of support for that on the congressional side. And my sense, you know, with this administration, but I think the consensus extends beyond it. They're going to find a lot of support for that, I think, in American, you know, sort of senior defense circles. But again, this is an opportunity to really think differently about how we conceive of our operations in space, how we build forces, and they really have a clean sheet to get this right.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Mara, over to you, my friend.
All right. Congrats on the book.
Thanks,
it is a very smooth and thoughtful read, as we've discussed. There are three things that struck me, and feel free to respond to any or all of them. So the first is the diagnosis, which I think is largely right. It is, I will say, profoundly ironic that we are even discussing military dominance when you mentioned the last 30 years, and of course, two-thirds of that have involved the U.S. military involved in the longest conflicts in contemporary U.S. history, which have been, at best, inconclusive. But I think this is a point that Frank walked to also, which is, well, how do you get others to care? Right? I mean, it's pretty grim. And yet, I think vis-a-vis the sort of China problem, there's this failure of imagination for a lot of folks. Obviously, COVID has, I think, shifted the thinking for a lot of people about the role of the military and the extent to which it should be prioritized. So you're writing, I think, a book that is obviously being discussed by us sort of like wonky, nerdy, you know, national security types. But in many ways, it's a book that I want a whole lot of other sorts of folks to read. Folks who haven't for the last kind of 10 years been sitting in meetings and saying, hey, this is looking really problematic. And so I wonder a lot about how you get them to care. And I think your book is a really good first step in that. So then turning to prescriptions, there are two points that kind of struck me. There's a lot on technology. While I think that's right, I would have liked more to be built out on the talent management side, on the people side. I mean, you've said, of course, that we're talking about having fewer and fewer people. So what does that look like? You know, it is so, there's this desire across the Pentagon, and I think you might concur across the Congress, to always talk about the stuff. Everyone gets excited about the stuff and where the stuff is made and what the stuff does. And when we talk about the people, it's often in like superficial platitudes. And I think that's unfortunate and going to be increasingly problematic if kind of the capabilities of those people would be increasingly significant. And then the third point is sort of how we think about pushing the change. Chris, I've joked with you that I found the book shockingly optimistic. I do think to have been a public servant, you have to have a little bit of this optimism sort of deep in your soul. Otherwise, you feel like you're just running into a wall over and over for no reason. But we, you know, the department, the Pentagon has had strategies come out really since 2012 that have said, hey, we need to worry about this. And yet changing incentives has just been profoundly difficult. Mike had referenced, you know, moving 5% of the budget. That sounds almost mind-boggling, right? I think toward the end of the Obama administration, when maybe we were moving 2% in this direction, I thought it was a huge win. And that's obviously like a little bit soul-crushing. And there's a lot of things that have been tried that you mentioned, right? So I've worked on budgets with Bishop's Funds where it says like, hey, compete for this special pot. That's nice, but it ends up usually being a really, really small pot. I think the Army and the Air Force have made some good changes in setting up Futures Command. And then for the Air Force warfighting integration capability, that's all goodness. But it seems to me at the end of the day, you're ultimately going to get this big change that you're suggesting only through really meaningful civilian control, where you're getting folks who are willing to issue kind of blunt guidance that says where to invest and where not to invest, folks who are willing to look holistically and willing to kind of make hard choices. And that's obviously difficult for valid reasons and for parochial reasons. So curious to hear your thoughts kind of on all of that. And I would just wrap with a reference. You had talked a little bit about kind of how the Pentagon does a budget request. And of course, Congress, it turns out as many folks in the department, myself included, occasionally wish to ignore that it turns out Congress obviously has power of the purse. But what I often found in the thousands of hours of budget discussions was this kind of this constant debate over how much to put things on the table. Right. The view was, well, we could put our views on the table, but Congress will never let us do X or Y. And there's a lot of validity to that argument. I'm actually pretty sympathetic to that argument, even though I ultimately and fundamentally think it is flawed. I think it is incumbent on the Pentagon to put forth the vision, you know, the request that it would like, knowing that it's going to get all turned apart. I'd be curious to just kind of hear your thoughts. What do you do about that that tension that exists?
Yeah, look, those are awesome questions, and I will try to do them justice. I would go, I guess, in reverse order. You know, from the standpoint of the tension, you were the only person I found who came away optimistic from this book, which is good because I didn't want to write a book that's conclusion was basically, well, we're screwed. You know, pack up into little wooden boats and let's just all kind of evacuate the mainland. I did want to try to say, look, I think there is a path here that we can go down. It's going to be really hard, though. It's going to some extent, I think, be more about establishing those processes that even if we can't say like exactly what the right answer is right now, we can say that we've kind of put in place processes that allow us to compete the right way to get to the right answer. And I 100% agree with you that that doesn't happen without serious, sort of strong, senior civilian leadership in the Department of Defense, because the military can't and shouldn't do this on its own, because these are decisions that go far beyond the military. They impact, they have political, economic, social ramifications. They obviously have national policy ramifications. These are civilian decisions. And they're not decisions that that unelected or kind of unconfirmed members of the civil service or the bureaucracy can take on their own, because they don't have the authority to. So for the same reason, this isn't something that they can or should do. These kinds of big changes have to come from strong senior civilian leaders. In terms of how to get those processes right, I mean, we talked about it a bit. I think where I try to focus my recommendations in the book are not at, if we buy this much artificial intelligence and sort of change some boxology here, make these cuts, like we're going to be good. I think the problems are structural and more systemic than that. And I think it kind of gets to what you were saying about, as I wrote this book, it was just shocking to me as I went back and looked at all the things that we have said and done for the past 25, 30 years. And how strikingly consistent they are. I mean, the things that we were saying in sort of the early 90s and the mid 90s about network-centric warfare, and the things that, even in the midst of, kind of post 9/11, we were saying that it was just so striking how we have been saying so many of the same things, but not actually doing as much of the things that we said were important to do, which suggests to me that this sort of failure to change has not been as a result of people not thinking about the problem right. I think many people were thinking about the problem right. The people on this call were, and part of that. It's that we didn't understand, or we didn't actually manage to sort of establish incentives that drove in the direction of the outcomes that we said were important. So to your point about the Congress, yes, you will always lose every fight that you never choose to take on. I was constantly frustrated with the department coming up and saying, oh, well, we can't do this because Congress wouldn't let us. I'd say, well, look, I mean, with respect, you're sitting in my office, like you know, I'm not Congress, but I work here. And, you know, don't assume anything is impossible before we have a conversation about it. And I try to point out a couple of instances in the book where we actually were successful, Congress and the Department of Defense working together to do some things that at the outset you might have said, like, you know, not recapitalizing the JSTARS program. You might have said would have fit into that bucket of, you know, look, Congress will never let you do that. It's impossible. There's too many jobs. There's too much political equity tied up in that program. But we were able to do it. And I think, you know, I try to walk through some things that I think that we did that enabled kind of the incentives to kind of align in the direction of the change that needed to occur. But again, to be clear, this is going to be really hard. And it's not just going to be civilian senior leadership of the department that's required. You're going to need senior active sort of leadership from the Congress in all the right places, you know, to be very aligned. And they're going to have to work on this as a team. I mean, my frustration in the Hill was that so often the senior ranks of the DOD and the Congress viewed each other adversarially. And there's plenty of reason for that. I get it. You know, there's checking and balancing that's healthy in our system. But, you know, when those two sides were not very tightly aligned, it created a massive seam that everyone could then jump into to exploit and pick them apart. Whether it was industry, whether it was, you know, parochial interests in the department or others, it just created, you know, this wedge where one side was played off the other. And, you know, I think ultimately the best outcomes didn't win the day in as a result of that. To your question about people, look, I fundamentally agree. I didn't spend the time on the book. I mean, the challenge with the book like this is sort of, you know, there's always the things about the book that you don't get to write. And I tried to keep it short. I was on sort of a breakneck deadline. Sort of people management, talent management was something that I just actively chose to stay away from because that's just, you know, it's like a book unto itself. But at the end of the day, I think that it is central to this. I do think that the way we recruit and retain members of the military and frankly, members of our civil service in the Department of Defense is just is antiquated. It's not going to hold up for the ways that people want to live their lives and structure their careers in the future. And it's not going to get us the best outcomes from a national defense standpoint. You know, we've got to get away from this sort of one size fits all. You know, you will enter the military service and have, you know, an unbroken 25, 30 year career. There just has to be more permeability for people to enter, to leave, you know, to not be penalized for that, but actually to be rewarded when they go out and have broadening experiences or, you know, experiences that make them better at their jobs and, you know, better able to come back in and add value from the standpoint of, you know, being an informed consumer of technology or a better manager of programs and people. I think we need to reward that and incentivize more of it because I think people are going to steer away from that career if that is, you know, sort of the world as it looks in 1975, you know, being offered to people, you know, who just don't want to live their lives that way. To back into your last question, which I think is the most important one, why should people care? You know, why am I writing this book? The question that I mentioned to you, I ask myself regularly in the process of writing this book, why am I doing this? I think that it is a trickier argument to make. I mean, you know, the challenge is that this is one of these problems that I think is sort of large and transcendent. It's not always the thing that is urgent today. You know, so, you know, whether it's kind of the war on terrorism or kind of COVID now, there always seems to be kind of a wolf closer to the door. And, you know, I think those are real and those are challenges that we have to address. But I think that we have to put them in a broader sort of framework or a broader perspective that, you know, ultimately, my opinion, you know, one of the, I think the defining strategic challenge for the United States moving forward is going to be, you know, kind of the continued rise of China and sort of all of its implications. It's not the only challenge. I think there are other things there that, you know, are going to be important. They're going to focus the mind when it comes to defense strategy. But to the question of why do we care? I don't think that, you know, tomorrow the United States and China are going to be at war with one another. I do think, you know, it's like the old adage of nuclear weapons. Well, how often do you use your nuclear weapons? Well, I use them every day, you know, to deter nuclear conflict, to keep, you know, bad actors kind of in their box. My concern about the world we're moving into is that in the absence of conventional deterrence, adversaries are going to begin making a very different calculus about what they can do in the world, how they can pursue their interests, what they can do to us and our allies and people and places that we care about. And we need to have sort of a more historically accurate and sort of fatalistic imagination about the world as I think it has existed is not necessarily the one that we've been living in for the past 25 years. I think things are kind of tense and challenging right now, but they can get a lot worse. And I don't think that, that necessarily means, oh, well, it's like World War III. I think it's more about, in the absence of conventional deterrence, in a world where we have adversaries that actually think they can get their ways through violence, what does that mean in terms of how they're going to engage with us diplomatically, economically? How are they going to use their influence against our allies? How are they going to try to sort of pin us down, isolate us, deny us friends? I think that very slowly we could end up in a world that looks very different than the one we've become accustomed to, that looks a lot worse than the world we have today. And if we can't imagine that that is an actual outcome, I think that it makes it more likely that we end up there. I don't want to go that direction. And I think, having the influence, having the friends and allies, having the ability to, contest things and compete peacefully without having to resort to violence, aggression, coercion. I think all of that stems from having, military capabilities that that lead competitors in the world to wake up every day and say, this really isn't a day that I want to pick a fight with the United States of America or its friends. This isn't a day where I want to risk brinksmanship or an act of aggression or something that, maybe I think I could get away with. That to me is victory. And every day that we can go to sleep at night having, kind of kept the peace is a good outcome for us. So I think that's ultimately the reason we have to change. And all the sort of second and third order consequences that stem from that.
Fantastic, Chris. Thank you, Frank and Mara. I'm now going to provide two questions that have essentially come in from the audience. I'm going to aggregate. The first set of questions is, Chris, to ask you to go a little further in terms of specificity about any changes you might advocate for process or structure, either on Capitol Hill. Do we need a two-year budget? Should we merge the appropriations and authorization committees? Are the intelligence and foreign relations and authorization committees properly demarcated and delineated in their responsibility? There's also questions that have to do with the Pentagon structure, including whether the current members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff should include the service chiefs, whether there should be some kind of a fundamentally different structure at the National Security Council. So in that whole realm of government structure and process, I'm asking you an impossibly big question, so I'm asking really just for one or two specific ideas that you might want to highlight here, encouraging people, of course, to read the book for other ideas.
Sure. When it comes to process and structure, I mean, what I try to focus on in the book is what we've talked about here in terms of how do you realign the incentives so that, competition and, kind of experimentation leads you more likely to the kinds of better solutions to the outcomes that we're trying to achieve, the problems we're trying to solve. In terms of things that are more specific than that, kind of more structural reforms, I'll point out too. I became an advocate on the Hill for merging the authorization and appropriations processes and committees. I think that the de facto reality for the past 20 years is that we haven't really had an authorization and appropriations process for the vast majority of what the Congress does. Defense is, I think, literally the last place where you have a separate authorization and appropriations process. So de facto, we have already been living in a world where authorization and appropriation has been consolidated. We seem to be doing okay with that. From a defense standpoint, my concern with that divide is it creates a massive seam in the Congress that the Department of Defense can play the Congress against itself. And this plays out every day. I mean, you literally have different parts of the department whose job it is to deal with the authorization committees, vice, the appropriations committees, and they're not allowed to talk to one another. They're not allowed to collaborate with one another. I think it would be a better, more streamlined outcome. I think that we would spend a lot less of our time. I mean, I spent countless hours on the Hill, working with, negotiating with, fighting with the appropriators, collaborating with them, synchronizing, getting into alignment. That's a lot of extra process, which I'm not sure actually adds a lot of extra value. I actually think a unified process where you're looking at, authorizing and appropriating, overseeing expenditure, making policy is the better way to go. And we've kind of been doing that for most of the functions of government for the past two decades anyway. On the DoD side, I think the biggest concern I have is where I see sort of ownership of problems and ownership of solutions out of alignment. That sort of informed, I think, a lot of the acquisition reforms that we made in my time on the Hill, where you had people who owned a problem, but they didn't sufficiently own the authority for solving it. One of the things that I, kind of am most concerned about when I look at the division is that, we have combatant commands who own the problem in the sense of they have to be, operationally ready. They have to build war plans. They have to be cognizant of the forces that they're going to need to execute the problems that they're going to have to solve. But they don't own the solutions for fielding those capabilities. Those lie with the services. I think that the process that we have to bring those two things into alignment through the joint staff, through OSD, is cumbersome, and it doesn't work very well, which is why I think you continue to see shortfalls in critical capabilities that combatant commanders have been banging the drum on for years and years and years. I also think it's interesting when you look at new combatant commands that have been stood up, whether it was Special Operations Command, Cyber Command, kind of was Space Command. Now it's kind of migrated into becoming the Space Force. We've actually created operational commands with service-like components and functions, where you have sort of a merging of operational responsibility and organized, train, equip responsibility. One way to look at that is that, we just kind of did it by accident. We weren't really thinking that we were kind of, critically challenging the way we've thought about these problems since Goldwater Nichols. I think the other way, which I tend to think of it is no, we were doing this intentionally. The nation was making a decision that having a tighter alignment between problem ownership and solution ownership, so that, the person who had the accountability for the problem also had the authority to solve it and wasn't fundamentally reliant upon someone else who may have a different set of priorities, a different set of political realities, and may not be interested in getting that individual everything that he needs. I think this is something we need to think about. I find it interesting at a time where joint all domain command and control is the reigning priority of the Department of Defense, we are still organized around territorial warfighting domains. There's something that's going to need to change in that. I'm not going to offer sort of radical, crazy ideas. This is something that I am thinking about. It's more to diagnose that I think there are disconnects between problem ownership and solution ownership, where we're going to need to find better ways of tightening that up than the ones we've relied upon, I think, to date.
Fantastic answer. Last question has to do with what you might consider the crown jewels of the country, its best technologists and also its best technology. And some of the questions concerned, how do we develop more human capital, building on the conversation you had with Mara a few minutes ago, but thinking even more nationally about that, to increase the talent pool writ large from which DoD draws a fraction of the nation's best science and technology expertise. And again, another set of questions had to do with supply chains, export controls, and how we make sure that we preserve robust American technology here in the United States and with American firms. Any comments on those two broad questions, please?
Yeah, I think they're actually quite related. The way I think of it is really from the standpoint of incentives. I think we have ended up in the situation we've ended up where so much of the best technology in the United States is not making its way fast enough and at scale into the Department of Defense, artificial intelligence and autonomy, distributed networking, things that members of our military use every day in their daily lives, in commercial products and services, but they don't have access to when they put their uniforms on. The fact that we have, this disconnect that everyone keeps talking about between, Silicon Valley and Washington, companies that don't want to work as much with the Department of Defense. I think this is a result of incentives that have existed for 20 or 30 years. Some created consciously, some created unconsciously, but the net effect has been that when you aren't buying the technologies that you say are important, when you're not actually helping them transition from interesting little science projects to established programs of record, you know, when so many new entrants are just, you know, perishing in the valley of death between, you know, kind of interesting upstart thing to, you know, a real scaled field of capability, they're going to walk. And that's what we've seen. You know, you've seen companies, startups, engineers, investors exit the defense sector because it hasn't been a good investment. And unfortunately, 30 years of evidence suggests that that's right. This isn't to say that you're going to be able to make the kinds of returns in defense that you are in commercial software. But you have to be able to do better than the sort of 2% margins that, you know, traditionally has been what, you know, the Department of Defense and Congress have been trying to sort of squeeze industry down to. I think that if the Department of Defense and Congress are actually putting more resources into the technologies that we're now saying are going to be central to military advantage in the future, you will begin to see, I think, a similar transition. It's not all going to happen in 1 year, kind of we were talking about earlier. But you're going to see more sort of best and brightest engineers say, look, I could actually create a successful defense company. I could build a successful defense product, and it could become something larger. It's a path for me to succeed and grow and scale. Investors are going to start saying, you know, look, defense isn't actually the wasteland that I thought it was. It's actually a place where companies can grow and succeed. So I'm going to put more of my investment capital into funding them, founding them, enabling them to get off the ground, recognizing that it's going to be a longer process than some of the rest of my portfolio. But I think that's ultimately how you begin to attract this talent back into the defense work. It's not through sort of talking through the problems. Like, we're actually going to have to change the incentives. We're going to have to make it less hard, less time consuming. But ultimately, and I think most importantly, we're going to have to make it a path to success and you know, sort of growth for people who are doing this work. And I think, you know, once you start to see some success cases in that respect, you're going to see more people incentivized to get involved. So again, that process will play out for a long period of time, but I think it's about getting the incentives right. And ultimately that comes down to where are we putting our money? And if we're putting our money into things that are attracting talent and attracting new companies and new investors, I think, you know, we're going to see a lot more of that in the future.
Chris, I want to thank you very much. I want to thank everyone who tuned in today, remind you of this excellent book, The Kill Chain. I don't know if it shows up backwards or mirrored on your screen. In any event, please consider purchasing it. It's an excellent read, as Frank and Mara and I all agree. And I want to thank my colleagues as well for the excellent comments and questions. But very best wishes with the book, Chris, with the company, and with all you're doing for the country. So we appreciate you joining us here today. And best of luck and best wishes to everybody else as we launch this crazy summer of 2020. And hope it goes well for you all. Thanks, and signing off from Brookings.
Thank you.